Gracious Father, thank you for the way that you draw us to yourself. Thank you for the way that you call us and send us out into the world. Lord, as we continue our discussion today, Lord, would you not just fill our minds, but would you also awaken our hearts, Lord, through all of us. In Christ's name. Amen. Okay, now we're going to shift into a bit more on this sort of research side of things, and we're going to look specifically at the question of hope. In order to lay the groundwork for it, though, we need to kind of define, like, okay, so what is a Christian hope, and in order to keep building from there. So, it's worth saying that my research question was, how is hope encoded and experienced in contemporary worship songs and services? And the word encoding there is maybe the one that's a little bit odd, but it's used because there's a technical sense in which the text of a ritual contains encoded messages and all of that. So I'll get to that a little bit in the next section. And so again, using hope because it's one aspect of theology. You can't say what's the theological content of these songs? You can't say that. You have to say, well, what specific theological content? So in my case, I chose hope for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons I chose it is because I like it. But another reason I chose it is because it's often sometimes said that the new sacrament for contemporary Christians is the worship music. And where Catholics have Mass, evangelicals have songs. And for whatever we think about that, and this isn't the place to go into that discussion, we do have the sense in which the Eucharist has an eschatological quality to it. The Eucharist points us toward a final feast. So, at least on those grounds, it's worth querying contemporary worship to say, okay, if this is the closest we get to a sacrament, then does it have an eschatological quality? Or what is its eschatological quiz? That makes sense. So that was kind of the link in there for me. Now, some of this next bit, if you are an academic, you will love. If you're not, just hanging there. It's only one slide. There's many ways of doing practical theology. One of the popular approaches is sometimes called the pastoral cycle. There are definitely simpler versions of the pastoral cycle. Okay, so before you look at this, just the simplest version of the pastoral cycle is, there's a situation or an experience, we're going to analyze the situation, we're going to reflect theologically on it to say, was that good, was that bad, and then we're going to have a recommended course of action. That's the simplest form. I'll give you an example. Decide to do video now. Very good. So you analyze the situation. What is it about video? Then you might maybe do all this stuff about mediated communication versus face-to-face communication and the polished nature of it and a screen versus a flesh and blood human being. So that would be your situational analysis. Then you do some theological reflection. Is this good? Is it bad? How do we appraise this theologically? And you come up with a recommended course of action. That's the simplest form of the cycle. This is a little bit more complicated because we take the experience and we say, all right, let's do a situational analysis of that experience. Then we do a theological analysis of the situation. So far, so good. We've talked about that. But now we go back and we do a situational analysis of the theology. We kind of say, yes, but by studying the situation more in depth, it actually calls into question some of the things we might have thought theologically. The example I used earlier with James Smith. So Smith does a kind of shorthand situational analysis of contemporary worship, says it's mostly expressive, then does a theological reflection and says we can't just be expressive, it has to be formative. But then you go back and do a situational analysis and say, let the situation question the theology and say, but people with low church forms are very much well-formed. So what do we do with that? So that would be how it continues to complete. We
complexify the situation.
That's not a word used.
And then the response and the experience. So that's part of the methodology. Another part of the methodology that's worth naming is Helen Cameron is a theologian in the UK. I can't remember which university she's at. But she and a number of other researchers came up with this method called the four voices. The four voices of theology. So it's not enough to say, oh, there's a theological implication for doing baby dedication instead of infant baptism. You have to say, but what kind of theology are we talking about? Or it's not enough to say, Chris Tomlin's songs contain a theology. We have to say, but what kind of theology is that? And so Cameron does a nice job here of outlining four different voices. She says there's a normative theology, which means the theology that comes from authoritative sources. There's an tell me if I'm blocking anyone's view here. There's an espoused theology, which is articulated belief. Sometimes this is called ordinary theology. This is the person in the pew. If you were to say to them, hey, what do you think about worship? And they said, I just think worship is all about us giving our all to God. Oh, great. And you say, well, that is a espoused theology. That's the articulated beliefs of ordinary folks. It's just what people say they believe, right? Then there's operant theology. I really appreciate Cameron making this distinction because sometimes what people say they believe is not actually the way they live. Shocker, right? All of us are this way. So, of course I believe this. So an example of this is the one that we used earlier about our espoused theology is, oh, our worship services are all about Jesus, right? But our operant theology is actually, it's all about the person on the jumbotron, whatever. Just an example. That might be the operant theology of that one person is needed here, even though they may not be willing to say it. Formal theology is a little different than normative, in that formal theology comes from academic theology. It comes from professional theologians. And so that would be the distinction. So normative would be from authoritative sources. Formal is slightly different than that, in that it can come from the academy. And the reason for that is, of course, many theologians can be working with the same authoritative sources and come up with different conclusions. Right? We know this. This is why we have denominations. So that's how you would distinguish those. Okay, pause button. Any questions on this? No? So far, so good? Okay. Now, this was important for me because of the way I went about my methodology. Then, there was the survey of 1,000 worship leaders for Songs of Hope, to identify a set of Songs of Hope, analyze those songs. Then there were two churches, which were my fieldwork churches, one Presbyterian, one charismatic, non-denominational, both large, both in suburbs of big cities, both sing contemporary worship songs, and replicated the survey with a focus group, also spent hours talking with the focus group, interviewed pastors, interviewed worship leaders, observed services. Those are all data points in sociological research. So then compared how the experience of hope was with the, another way of saying encoded hope, you could say expressed hope. How hope was expressed versus how it was experience. So we'll get there by midday tomorrow, but I just wanted you to see what's coming. Any questions on that method, on how that looked? Okay, so far? All right. This is very risky to do after lunch, you know, but we're going to do it. So models for hope. So when you say a word like hope, and even when you ask, you know, just sort of conversationally, we use the word hope very differently. Sometimes we say hope, but what we mean is optimistic optimism. Sometimes we say the word hope, and what we mean is a wish. A wish for this. And so I had to kind of break this down a little bit. How do we think about hope? And there's several models. So one is the psychological model of hope, which is both cognitive and affective. We will break down each of these models here in a moment. So this is just to have you see them There's a philosophical model of hope, which is about virtue ethics. That's about saying hope as a virtue, basically. There's the phenomenological model of hope, which is what does it actually look like to hope? What's the structural element of hoping, the act of hope, the act of hoping? And then the theological, we'll use the creed and some contemporary theologians, so we'll kind of do both normative and formal theology. Stop me at any point if this is like, I don't care, or don't tell me you don't care. All right, so we'll do one by one. Hope as a state. This is the cognitive model. So this is basically what psychologists will talk about when they talk about hope. There's a psychologist, I think from Harvard, named Charles Snyder, who has built the adult hope scale. You can actually Google that and find that online. It's an interesting thing. But it's also fairly simple to understand. What Snyder basically constructs is that hope, is, if you had an X and Y axis, axes, hope is where agency meets pathway. And so agency, pathway, what does that mean? What he means is the sense that you can, the ability and the plan. Or if you like, the power and the plan, to use some alliteration here. So agency is about power. Can you actually do anything? And pathway is about the plan. Do you know how? Interestingly enough, did anyone ever read the memoir, Hillbilly Elegy? Yeah, somebody read that. And it's interesting because at the end of it, Vance essentially talks about how his community had no sense of agency. And pathway. They didn't know that they could do anything different, and they certainly didn't know how. And it was only after he went in the Marines and then he had people that showed him how to apply for college and how to get scholarships and more financial aid and all of this stuff. And so even from a purely human perspective, when we talk about bringing hope to communities, from even just a human standpoint, what that looks like is people gaining a sense of agency and gaining a clear pathway. If people don't think they can change anything about their situation, and if they don't know how, there's going to be despair. So Snyder's work on this is very important because it puts hope in a very kind of plottable way. You can plot it out in terms of how high or low hope is and why. The weakness of Snyder's model is that it's not easily distinguished from optimism. Because let's say a person believed they had the power and was pretty sure their plan was going to work. That doesn't mean it will. Right? So how do we know that the person's own appraisal of their power and plan are worth anything? Right? So that's a bit of the weakness. It could just, in one sense, be overly subjective. All right, any questions on the cognitive model? Now the affective model, hope as an emotional experience. This was fun to kind of write about, and we'll do a session tomorrow purely on emotion. We'll talk a lot more about it. Emotions as concern-based construals. Now, this is such a complicated way to say it. This is from a guy at Baylor named Bob Roberts. Should have put his name in parentheses. I put other people's names in parentheses. What's wrong with you, vacuum? Bob Roberts writes about this. He's got a lay person-aimed book called Spiritual Emotions. It's very interesting. What's a concern-based construal? I mean, what is that? It's a way of seeing the world based on what you care about. So, hope as an emotion. Emotions are most always precognitive, meaning you don't think, feel angry, and then you get angry. You usually just feel angry. Because emotions come up pre-reflectively without you having to think about it, you can actually work backwards from an emotion to find out why. Right? So let's take an example here. Class gets out at 3:45, and all of a sudden it starts raining. One person says, "Oh." The other person goes, pre-reflectively, not consciously, not even like purposely, just, we would have to work backwards and say, so the person that was happy, why? Well, it's because something you care about affected you to construe the situation or see the situation in a positive light. So let's say you were invited to some picnic dinner that you really didn't want to go to. And it's raining. Time, you know? Or anger. You were hoping to make it to the beach, you know, because you hadn't seen the ocean in a while, you know? And anyway, you see what I'm saying. So concern-based construal. Another way of saying it is my friend who teaches at the Air Force Academy, who studied under Roberts, he says, it's the eyes of our heart. Reference to Paul Balazs intended. But the eyes of our heart, meaning the thing that we care about is seeing the world in a particular way. And that's what our emotions are. They're perceiving the world in a certain way. So when you experience an emotion of hope, you are seeing something. Okay? Paul Ekman has some work on endurable emotions. By the way, if you ever want to just really have a fun read, Ekman's book, Emotions Revealed, it's really fun. Paul Ekman is the scientist, 30 to 40 years of studying human emotions. He's the scientist behind a TV show that was on Fox years ago called Lie to Me, mm-hmm. about facial expressions. It's Ekman's research that was the basis of that show. Or, if you have young kids, Ekman's science was also behind the movie Inside Out.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's great. Ekman's book is fun. Emotions Revealed. It's really, really interesting. He studied emotions across all kinds of different people groups, including those that had no Western experience, that were what we would call from a particular vantage point pre-literate. So the ones that don't even use words, and he would hold up pictures and narrate stories, and facial expressions for emotions, for at least four common emotions, are universal. And so then Ekman goes on to talk about why that is. It's really, really fun, you know. And then you can just, you know, have fun with this at your dinner parties with all your friends, you know. And when their eyes are wide, you're like, oh, what's going on there? All of that. So optimism, again, there's an emotion that can feel like this, an attitude about the likelihood of experiencing enjoyable emotion. So optimism isn't technically an emotion, but it's an attitude about the likelihood of experiencing positive emotions. Does that make sense? So again, these are social scientists trying to pin it down a bit. What is optimism? Optimism is the attitude about the likelihood of experiencing some enjoyable emotions, like happiness. I like it Inside Out where she says, stay positive. I'm positive we're lost. It's like, yeah, I can't be optimistic here. So that's a little bit of how hope from the model of emotions and affect may impact us here. Okay, next month. What if we talk about hope as a virtue? Now here we have a little bit of Christian theology slowly working its way in. Hope as a virtue. So the object of Christian virtue is fixed, but the experience of hope may actually fluctuate. Now, lots of people have done work on this. Begley actually quotes and interacts with it some in his writing on music and emotions. But we can say that moods have no objects, but emotions have objects but are episodic. Okay, let's break that down for a little bit. Okay, so someone says to you, "What's the matter with you? You seem a little off today." And you're like, I don't really know what I'm mad about. I'm just in a grumpy mood, right? So we kind of know this. Moods, it's not aimed at anything. It's not aimed at a particular person or a particular event. It's just a sort of mood. But emotions, there's something that happened here. Someone got upset. It was those video announcements again, you know? It's aimed at something, but it's episodic. Just because it's aimed at something doesn't mean it's constant, right? We all know this. You might experience a positive emotion or a negative emotion aimed at something or someone, but it can fluctuate. All right. Roberts here says that actually emotions can develop into a character trait through endurance. So you experience the emotions of joy regularly enough, you might be able to cultivate joy even in the face of hardship. Right? And so Robert says that's the point at which an emotion actually gets turned into a virtue. Now that's an interesting idea. Again, now, so we've done sociologists, this is like a philosopher talking. So it's kind of theoretical, but plausible. You're like, I can see that. So one of the things to think about as worship leaders is, it's not totally wasted to have people experience particular emotions in church. Right? Sometimes what's said is, oh gosh, it was just so emotional. As if that is somehow less than. Or like, who cares about that? Just throw it. It's just an emotion. You're just going to throw it away. Robert says, oh, hang on. If we're careful about this, people can actually move from the experience of that emotion into an actual character trait. How do you move from feeling joyful to having the quality of joy? How do you move from feeling hope to actually developing hope? Well, one of the ways you do that is by cultivating it even when the conditions are not right for it. Right? It's easy to have hope when everything's going your way. But how do you sustain hope when things are not? So now all of a sudden we realize, well, hang on now. Hope as a virtue requires a certain kind of resilience. So one of the things we're going to look at tomorrow is when people experience hope in worship services, is that hope resilient at all? Or is it the kind, is it, so critics of modern worship say, it's just a high, and it doesn't last. Well, let's find out. Is that true? How could it last? Does it really impact people who are going through real stuff? I had people in my focus groups who were dealing with everything from infertility to custody battles to a broken relationship that was going to be headed to marriage or was heading toward marriage. So how does hope hold up? Is there any resilience to it? So it was important to think about hope through the lens of a virtue. Does that make sense? We okay so far? Yes? Yes? No? Yes? Okay. Hope as an act. Now this part really gets into the philosophical abstract. Thank you, Jamie Smith. Jamie Smith's work on this is really, really wonderful. There's a book called The Future of Hope, and he has a chapter in it that is really fantastic. And he outlines the structural elements of hope. So some of this might seem obvious, but it's worth naming it. In order for hope to happen, you have to have a hoper, someone. You have to have an object. And this is key. The object has to be in the future, and it has to be good. Because if it's in the future but not good, what do we call that?
Despair.
Despair or dread or fear, even. Worry, anxiety, there's other words. But in order for it to be a hope, it has to not just be in the future, but it has to be a good future. And now you're all thinking of Jeremiah 29:11, right? Like a good future. Okay, an act, it also has to have an act, consciousness. There's a sense of consciousness here of hoping. There's a ground, there's a basis. This is where Smith is particularly helpful because this is more helpful than Snyder's work on this issue. It reminds us that we need a basis for our hope. So you don't just need, you know, Snyder talk about agency and pathway, you also need to know on what basis. Like, is this actually true or not? You can think that your plan to get to college is going to work from your community, but if there isn't actually a scholarship available, then you have no basis for being optimistic. Fulfillment or realization, which would be the sort of the thing, the telos that hope points toward, the end goal that hope points toward. Last one for a model of hope. Is the eschatological vision or the theological model. So here I surveyed, I think, Brian Daly's book, The Hope of the Early Church, and Chris Hall's book, Theology of the Church Fathers, doing theology with the church fathers maybe. And they both have some interesting things to say, but more or less, the hope of early Christians kind of gets crystallized here in the Nicene Creed. So there are things that show up. Many of them are in the New Testament, but then it gets kind of crystallized here in the phrases. So here are the phrases. He will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead. And then at the very end of the creed, the last line, we look for the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. So I'm calling that the normative theology. We're working with Helen Cameron's Four Voices. That would be the normative theology. So what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to create a normative and formal kind of theology of hope against which to compare the songs. And then when we get to the experience part of hope, we're going to pull in the stuff from the psychology and sociology of emotions and all that, and to do that. There's clearer lines there. All right? Okay, good. Now, let's say more. Hope is eschatological, there's a theological model, blah, blah, blah. All right, now, formal theology. We need some theologians here. We need some contemporary theologians. I use Jürgen Moltmann and N.T. Wright. Moltmann's book, The Theology of Hope, was probably the first kind of groundbreaking work of bringing the subject of eschatology back into the forefront of theological consideration. Most systematic theology textbooks, where does eschatology land? The last chapter. And maybe because it's like, oh, it's the study of last things, you know? Yes, but Moltmann is the one who says, look, you got to put it right next to Christology. Mm-hmm. Like, when you talk about Jesus, we have to talk about the reason why the ending of the story is different now. So that's a big shift. I would say on a more layperson, widespread version of this, N.T. Wright's work has probably been widely influential. Anyone read Surprised by Hope? By Wright? Okay, it is phenomenal. Both of them, though, place their emphases in different places. Where Moltmann kind of emphasizes the presence, because he talks about the coming of God. If you've, in fact, one of Moltmann's later books, so he wrote Theology of Hope as a 30-something, which is pretty crazy, maybe 27-year-old, kind of nuts. And then toward the end of his career, he wrote The Coming of God, which is his eschatology in a little more structured format. So, but Moltmann focuses on presence. It's all about where is God, you know, as you, when God fills the earth again with his glory. Wright tends to focus a little bit more on a narrative, and so the emphasis tends to be on the faithfulness of God. And so you could say that it's really about agency, the God coming through in the end. When you look at hope from a theological lens, there's a space and a time. Dimension of this that I get at it. So, all right, we're hanging there, peeps. We're almost there. When you get to this, you then name seven facets of hope. If we put all of these models together, you kind of will see it this way. You'll say, well, hope is an act. Hope has a grounds. Hope has an object. Hope has an agent. Hope has a path. Hope has a space. Hope has a time. Arguably, you could say, well, space and time is about the object, right? It's what you're hoping for. That's what Jamie Smith's thing does. But I think it's worth splitting out space and time, and you'll see why in a moment when we look at songs. When you look at songs, it becomes really important why space and time matter. All right, so if we put it together, what is our normative and formal theology of hope? Christian hope is a confident assurance grounded in God's promise and faithfulness as revealed in the scriptures in general and in Christ in particular, that the triune God will bring about the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come at the time of Christ's appearing, making heaven and earth new and one by means of what has already been accomplished at the resurrection of Jesus. Whoa! But that's our loaded paragraph, and I'd love to know what you like, what you don't like about this. When you look at what popular evangelical espoused theology of hope is like, it actually looks very different. So, one of the things I, this is a proposed taxonomy, just a way of calling things, right? Academia is about using big words for simple things. I had to kind of come up with different kinds of hope that I think is out there that's popular, you know. And number three. And there's some interesting work done on this. There's a historian named Matthew Sutton who wrote a book called The American Apocalypse. If you really want to know a detailed kind of play-by-play of how Americans got to a left-behind sort of quote, it's a really interesting mix of forces and of factors. So I kind of named them this way. I named it as new creation, explanation, evacuation, compensation. And I described them as such. New creation is God will set it right one day. I mean, there's probably more that could be said, but I'm trying to say this simply. Explanation, God will explain it to me one day. Evacuation, God will get me out of here one day. And compensation, God will make it up to me one day. Now, I use this in my survey with worship leaders. So part of this part of the research was done in partnership with Integrity Music. And so they have an email list of about 25,000 worship leaders. At least they did when this was done a couple years ago. But I had 1,000 respond out of the 25,000, 966 or so. And there's 25 questions on there, a couple of which are the ones that focus on songs, which we'll explore next session. And then there were some that just asked them about hope. And I'll show you some of these responses in the very next session. I even put two statements side by side. Statements like, Christ is here with me, or Christ will come again in glory. Both true. And asked them to say which one brought them more hope. I won't tell you which they said, but that's the next session. But I also put these phrases. I didn't put the name of it. I didn't call it, restoration. That's supposed to say new creation. I didn't put the names of those phrases. I just put the sentences. I just put, God will set it right one day. God will explain it to me one day. God will get me out of here one day. God will make it up to me one day. I just put those sentences. And I said, rank these in the order of which gives you most hope. And the majority of worship leaders, you can see, lean towards God will set it right one day. That was sort of their number one. But it's interesting that when you get lower down, then you kind of see, well, which ones were close behind or as number twos. So the orange, if you can't see that, represents the national worship leaders, so the whole list, 966. Then I filtered it out to say, well, how about just Presbyterian worship leaders? The reason I did this is because my field work was with the Presbyterian Church and with the Charismatic Church. So I wanted to see national trends before the specific churches. So the red is Presbyterian churches, the gray is Pentecostal Charismatic worship leaders. And you can see that explanation figures high, but evacuation has the highest among Pentecostal Charismatic worship leaders. So God will get me out of here. Yeah, in one sense, you're like, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense. Presbyterians tended to have a slightly better than the general population view of restoration or new creation. God will set it right one day. Could be that they're creedally formed, you know, that they have more, at least they know that vocabulary that's in there. Anyway, there it is in a different kind of chart.
Was it intentional that the first question didn't have a personal reference?
I've gotten that a few times now that I presented it. It was not intentional, but that might have been a bit of a flaw. Because everything else is personalized. The first one is all-encompassing. God has set it right.
Isn't that inherent in the explanation?
But I think so. I mean, I think so. I think everything else is sort of, you know, individualistic, but like new creation would have to be new creation for everyone, you know. Go ahead. Was it? Sure?
But Glenn, with that thought process, though, it's still amazing of the respondents with new creation, even though it wasn't personalized, it's
yes.
still whole
yes.
creation still was the number one.
Yes. Yes, and you can see more clearly from the pie chart, more so by the by Presbyterian worship leaders. Presbyterians are more likely to believe in it than the other group, than the general group, or and certainly than Pentecostals. In fact, Pentecostal charismatics are the least likely to rank it number one. 46% of them put it there. But generally, the same trends hold. The one that's the lowest is compensation. God will make it up to me. You know, although I do feel like if you really press people, and I this wasn't the entire the focus of it, so I didn't go too deep on this, but people do talk that way, you know, like, well, one day I'll get my mansion, or, you know, so I don't know that that is really quite, but maybe if you really press people and say, do you really believe God's going to make it up to you, they'll say, no, I wouldn't say that, you know, so they at least know the right language to use. Okay, I know that all of this is only very tangentially related to worship, but I needed to do this to set up the next session. So the next one is about the songs, and then we're done for the day. Tomorrow morning we start with talking about emotion and experience in the presence of God, and then we talk about the analysis of services. Then after lunch we talk about the theology of the Spirit and how that can help us here, and then the final session is a little bit a return to kind of praxis here for pastors and worship leaders and all that. Okay, any questions, thoughts, comments on any of this, I guess? Jonathan, yeah?
Were you saying that there is a difference in what you found between optimism and hope, or were you using them interchangeably?
No, I'm not using them interchangeably. I'm saying that there need that if we don't identify grounds or basis as one facet of hope, then we have no way to distinguish it from optimism.
Right. Yeah. I'm interested in the concept that God will explain it to me one day.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
Where?
It's not biblically based.
No, it's not. It's not. But
I mean, I've heard this before.
Well, that's it, and that because. Because I've heard it as well, I put it in there as an option just to see would people attach to that. And, you know, I mean,
it's almost like we're going to go to heaven and God's going to explain everything to us as individuals without regard to anybody else.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think there's this sense of like, well, I don't get it now, but one day I'll understand it.
Yeah. You know? I think that's a different concept than God explaining it.
Really?
Yeah. God answered all my questions. Why yeah. this
happened
in
my life. Yeah.
One of our old camping songs was, we'll understand it better by and by.
Oh, really?
When the morning comes.
Yeah. We I will think you get that the vision is 2020.
Okay.
So if you were to experience something and then look back on it,
yeah,
in the good. Moment, yeah, I said it's 2020, is what
yeah.
I was trying
yeah.
to say.
Yeah.
It's too large to see in the middle, but in the end,
yeah.
looking back, even the suffering will look like
yes.
a working of God. I think that's probably what the sentiment pokes at.
I think so too, and I think one of the reasons I put it in there is just a prompt to see what that would cue in people, you know, and also to just see how much we rely on the cognitive, you know, how even our conceptualizing of hope needs to satisfy our cognitive longings, you know. Because, listen, if people had said, look, God will explain it to me one day, the ultimate, then it's not likely that worship could really give you hope. So worship doesn't explain anything.
In a sense, you're measuring focal length. None of those things
are wrong.
All of those things
yeah.
are going
yeah.
to happen.
Yeah. Yes.
But
yes.
If the end measure of what you're aiming for is only here, it's impoverished. You're missing the greater point.
That's exactly it. And in a sense, I'm measuring degree, like how much weight do we give to which thing, and you said focal point. Do you mean like in terms of scope?
Well, no, more of a photography thing.
Okay.
Is your focal distance, you know, 3 meters, or is it infinite? You know, is it?
That's good. Yeah. Sam?
I think there's a sense that, I mean, there's a lot of people that the new creation is a luxury to think about.
Mm-hmm.
But God will get me out of here one day, addresses right now
mm-hmm.
my problems
mm-hmm.
That are not theoretical.
Yes.
You know, I don't have enough food. Or
right.
I can't find work, or, you know, my spouse is dying, or I'm dying.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. So.
I think that's true. And sometimes maybe it is the sheer scope of that first one, new creation. Look, man, I don't know about all that, but I just need this. You know, it could be.
There's a bit of a flip side to that, too, though, right? Because if the first is the universal, we all experience it, but the other ones, I could potentially be excluded from that.
Interesting.
And that made me be a little more fearful to
right.
choose that option.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, maybe. I mean, they all chose it as number one, but it's 2, 3, and 4 that get jumbled a bit. Which one comes in next? But the reason this will matter, you guys, is because the next session we're going to look at songs that worship lead, these same worship leaders said brought them hope. And I asked two questions. I said songs that brought you hope in a time of despair, and songs that bring your church hope. And then I aggregated the two lists together. So that's what we'll look at in a minute. And I think that's important because worship leaders, for better or for worse, are the gatekeepers of the songs that the church sings. And if this is how they rank what gives them hope, then they'll choose songs accordingly. I mean, one of the curious things, I could have even gotten more specific and said, actually I did, but there was nothing remarkable, there was no singular answer that rose to the top, but like a song that you would sing at a funeral service.
Mm-hmm.
You know? What is in our repertoire that will be useful to us in those moments? Is there anything? And that's an interesting thing. I mean, so when I interviewed the two different pastors, the Presbyterian pastor, not surprisingly, had a very developed theology of hope. Been to seminary, he even used kind of an analogy about a photoscopic lens and talked about like, what did he say? He said, faith is like now, but hope is when you extend it into the future. So it was something very clever. Oh, that's very nice. The Charismatic Church, I met with one of their very, very large campuses, and the campus pastor didn't have too much to say about that. He comes from a business background, no theological training. But the pastor who had preached the weeks right before I began my field work had just done a long series on the end times. And so I listened to all those sermons. And it was straight up like rapture theology. Very different. And then when I put in the focus group, they both groups were kind of looking towards heaven. So neither group demonstrated this ability to talk about restoration or new creation or resurrection. Any of those creedal phrases just wasn't there. It was like, just can't wait to be in heaven. Again, that's not wrong. It's just less than what the creed kind of gives to us, or what Christian hope has been. So we go back to our paragraph of what Christian hope is. Like, yeah, that wasn't really there.
Mm.
Agency's there, Pat, all of that stuff, but the object was off. It was kind of truncated, was short. So the popular vision, the popular Christian vision of hope is nothing like what we would want it to be. The other thing that was kind of discouraging is not related to the dissertation. I've done a small scale project on funeral sermons. And in none of the funeral sermons I analyzed, none of them mentioned the resurrection.
What?
Yes. They all talked about heaven. They all talked about where the beloved deceased was now. And it was like, I can only imagine theology. You know, like, I can only imagine. I'm sure they're dancing. I'm sure they're doing. Which is not. Listen, this is not this. For the pastoral use, it brought comfort. It worked. You know. Did it bring a bigger vision of hope? I don't know. I don't think so. You know. One of the pastors I interviewed actually said to me, "Oh, I believe in the future resurrection of the dead and all that, but I just don't know that the grieving people need that at the funeral."
So when you talk about funerals, did that include also memorial services?
Yes.
Well,
yes.
I would think memorial services would be different than a funeral service.
In your mind, is the difference with whether the casket is there or not, or
no,
what's the
no,
difference
no.
to you? Okay, sorry, yeah.
Looking forward to eternity. Essentially, in memorial service, more so recognizing
okay.
that person has already come forward as a spirit.
Yeah. Most of these services were like a celebration of the person's life. You know, like this is
without regard to
with a lot of talking about where they are now,
yeah.
but with very little discussion to no discussion about what is to come.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Other than one day we'll be with them in heaven too. So popular Christian hope is a long way off from the formal and normative theologies of Christian hope. Yeah. And this was not my focus. It was about the experience of it in the songs, but I had to do some of this just to lay the backdrop. So I can't tell you authoritatively here about what popular Christian hope is, but I can say that in the two focus groups at two churches and some of the survey with worship leaders, sometimes the worship leaders, sometimes they said the right thing, sometimes they said something that was a little contradictory. And the focus groups, the resurrection of the dead never came up. Like, it was all heaven. Like, if I said, so what do you think is your hope as a Christian? Or what keeps you going? Or what are you waiting for? And some of them even said, one of the focus groups was a group of people, had some people that were toward kind of their last several laps or whatever in life, you know, and so one of them kind of chuckled and goes, oh, I got nothing left to hope for here, my life's pretty much done, I'm just waiting for heaven, you know, and as if I meant hope, as in like, what are you looking for God to do now, you know, so the idea of a long-form view of hope, like the end of all things, it's not really on their radar, even though their pastor had developed theology. Does that make sense? So it's kind of, it's just interesting that the popular notions of Christian hope are so far out there that there's even a gap between the pulpit and the pew. Now the one who did all the rapture series, the people were just like, I don't know, does it even matter? You know, if anything, what that series did was convince them that all this stuff is irrelevant speculation anyway. And they're like, oh, it stirred up a lot of controversy, but who really cares? I mean, Jesus is coming again, there's probably going to be a rapture. So what? You know, it's kind of that was what the worship leader of that camp was sort of like that. And you know, so either way, the net result is, from the lived experience of an ordinary worshiper, Christian hope is, and theology of resurrection and all this stuff is like, has no merit.
My question to you is, do you think that language played a role in people's even understanding of resurrection of the dead, kind of getting folded in, I think maybe on heaven,
mm-hmm.
coming beyond, encompassing all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I found language with some of those things to be the biggest obstacle. I did a very much smaller scale survey of members of our congregation about the Apostles' Creed and what
yes.
they thought communion of saints meant. And I would say 98% of those interviewed meant living Christians,
yeah.
other Christians in the world.
Yeah.
Which is not at all what
no.
Christians are getting at. But I found that when we examined the language, we're like, oh, no, that's not what I thought it meant at all. But
yeah.
just in the flat reading of it.
Yeah.
So language was an issue there.
Language is absolutely an issue. With the focus groups, the questions were very open-ended. I mean, obviously with the surveys and stuff, but
But with the focus groups, it was like, so tell me about what is Christian hope to you? You know? And basically they would say things like, well, I was a sinner, Jesus came, and I'm going to go to heaven when I die. None of which is false. All of that is true. It's just missing some things. But again, maybe to them, the things that it's missing are sort of irrelevant. It's kind of like, yeah, well, I don't know. We could be wrong. So why does it matter? Yeah.
I think some of this goes back to that first session where you said worship can be viewed as encounter, mission, or formation.
Mm.
The church is a buy into the mission.
Yeah.
Songs are very much where you're at today. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be afraid. Mm-hmm. I'm going to. And so it's not being driven, it's being driven by how to attract the theologically trained.
Yes.
So it's dumbed down on purpose to a temporal hope.
Yes.
And the hope is, once you catch them, somewhere you can get biblical hope.
Backfill.
Through confirmation or something.
Yeah.
So it has very much to do with the kind of church. You know, I was raised Lutheran. We never talk about hope for tomorrow.
Yeah.
Never. And our church is half African American. It's always about hope for tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We're gonna overcome. We're gonna be better. Things are gonna get better. And it's more of a hope now versus hope in the future.
Yeah.
And I think what you're arguing, if I'm hearing you right, is that the biblical hope always seems to be tied. Eschatological.
Yes.
And if it's just present-driven,
yes,
you have to connect the dots somehow.
Correct. No, you're exactly right, Dan. And I think that is true, that so many of our churches have such a dominantly mission-oriented paradigm that we've kind of reduced it to what's the bare minimum here? Hey, sins, Jesus' death, heaven. And so as long as we get those few things right, everything else is like extra credit. You
and
know?
Even a non-Christian who sings, I'm not afraid.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid. Even a non-Christian will cry to that.
Sure. Yeah. It's a felt need.
Because it's a felt need and it's addressing, you know, what they're going
through. Lester Ruth tells this interesting story just of years ago when he was doing pastoral work in the Methodist context. You know, he's teaching them sort of like a new believer's class. You know, he's teaching through the creed. And he says, okay, the line, we believe in the resurrection of the dead. That this is the Apostles' Creed wording of it, shorter, right? And he says, what do you think that means? And he said, people were like, Jesus.
Yeah.
Like, they thought it was talking about Jesus' resurrection. And he was like, and? And they're like, what? You know, so there is a sense, even in liturgically formal churches, where the wording is misconstrued or misunderstood or just missed, you know? Yeah, Vinny.
Even piggybacking on what Dan just said, I wonder if there's any way with the groups that you had, if there's any way for you to know, did you have any demographic information or cultural information to see, you know, are these all, like, people dealing with first world problems? Like, God will explain it to me one day why I didn't get the promotion, will explain it to me one day why my kids didn't have water.
Yeah.
You know, is there a connection between where we find hope?
Vinny, you are on the money. And we are going to get there in the next session, and it's going to make us squirm a little bit. So.